liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss the danger of reducing government services with Congressman Elijah Cummings and ideas to spark the manufacturing sector with Congressman Adam Schiff. We'll also learn about the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's Safe Sleep campaign with spokeswoman Nikki Fleming. But first, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski joins us. Witold, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Witold, SSA is cutting back its availability to the public. Specifically, the agency, effective November 19th, is going to close its field offices 30 minutes earlier, and then in January, field offices will close at noon on Wednesdays. What's behind this move?
Well, unfortunately, the agency to date hasn't really explained it thoroughly to the union, but what it appears to be is an attempt. The overtime has been severely curtailed, and one of the problems in field offices is late interviews, and folks who come in late in the office, the vast majority of offices will do their interview even if it goes past the closing time, and that in some cases results in overtime being used. Now, the agency, based on the continuing resolution, has decided to budget next to no overtime, so they're arguing that to inhibit overtime use, they're going to close the office a half hour early. I think, however, there are all kinds of ways that you can leave the offices open till 3:30, even 4 o'clock, and still allow the public those extra hours to access face-to-face interviewing and still prevent the usage of overtime. It's just a matter of scheduling. Somebody comes in late in the day and wants to file a disability claim at 3:45, that takes an hour and a half. There should be no expectation from the public that we're going to stay there and take the claim. We can do those on another day by appointment and take care of that business. But I think there's a different motive, and that is that the they cut a half hour last year on the time of the office opening. They want to cut a half hour this year, and then they want to cut a whole 5 hours on Wednesday starting in January. Now, that's a cut of about 22% of the office hours that the public has available to have a face-to-face interview with a Social Security employee. They've also closed 41 different offices in the last 2 years and shut down 300 part-time contact stations. So I think this is all about shifting the way service is delivered to the public. I think the current commissioner, Astrew, is interested in putting as much of the intake that comes into the agency on the Internet. They have advertising campaigns asking the folks to file on the Internet. They require our employees who answer the 800 number calls to encourage the public to use the Internet. They're even putting in self-help kiosks in our offices, so people come in for the purpose of having a face-to-face interview. They're being directed to sit down at a kiosk and do their business through the Internet, even though that wasn't their intention when they came in the office. And I think it's very dangerous to shift service to that degree to the Internet. They're already doing about, their goal for this year is to have 48% of retirement claims on the Internet and 40% of disability claims on the Internet. The people that take these claims, we've surveyed them, our employees, claims representatives, and they've identified huge problems with Internet claims where people make decisions that are not to their advantage. When you file for retirement, you oftentimes have choices of when you want to start your retirement benefits. Oftentimes people don't understand what the impact is of their choices. If you have an interview with a Social Security employee, either by telephone or face-to-face when you're filing a claim, we'll explain that to you. We'll say if you want to start, you have options to when you start your benefit. You can start it in January. You can start it when you reach age 65. You can start somewhere in the middle. And here's the effect that would have. Here's how much money you'll get. Here's how much back pay you might receive. You'll be ahead for X amount of years. None of that explanation yet do you get on the Internet, and SSA is a pretty complex program. Oftentimes people, when they file on the internet, they don't answer all the questions. They fail to put in a spouse who might be eligible for benefits or children who might be eligible for benefits. And that will result in huge losses of entitled benefits for those spouses and children. So we think that, you know, we anticipate more office closings. We think the Wednesday, the particular Wednesday closing at noon that the agency is proposing to happen in January is, they haven't said this to us, but I have a sneaking suspicion that it's connected to possible furloughs next year if the agency gets their budget cut or if there's sequestration. They've put in a place marker in there where, you know, we're going to say the offices are going to close, are only going to be open for 3 hours on Wednesday. It'd be easy for us then to tell the employees to go home. They're on furlough. And if you look at it in the course of a year, 52 times 5 hours, you're talking over 32 and a half days of furlough. So they haven't said that, but as I look at the way the budget looks, and with sequestration happening, unless Congress does something in the lame duck session, that's our concern.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Witold Skvirchinski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, this move figures to significantly impact public service. And as you know on the show here, many times we've talked about the impact of budget cuts on public service. This one figures to be, or has to be, somewhere near the top of the list of the impact on people relying very, very clearly on public service.
Yeah, the last year, 2 years ago, the commissioner proposed similar measures of doing a pilot and closing some offices early, some every day, others a day a week, and Congress people in the districts where they were proposing the pilot got very upset and put pressure on the commissioner to back off on this change. We're in a different climate now. We have this vast concern on the Hill of budget deficits, and you know, when agency officials suggest that you know, we can save some money because on overtime in this case by closing offices early, you know, there's less pushback from the Hill. But what I fear, and what many of the people I represent fear, is that if people lose confidence in Social Security, they're apt to be more prone to arguments coming from the right, where SSA should be privatized. We should contract out the services that federal employees now provide for Social Security. We need to. Social Security's broken. We need to fix it. I don't think that all those things are true. I think Social Security isn't broken. In you know, 20, 25 years out, where the actuaries think there's a problem with solvency, we may have to do a few things, like increase the taxation level for the wealthy who stop paying taxes on Social Security after $110,000 and $100 a year of earnings. But I think that you know, that there's an agenda here to break the confidence level of people in SSA and in the delivery of SSA services. Frankly, if we're going to cut 8 hours a week of services, the expectation is that we're going to have to do the same work, same interviewing work, in eight less hours. Now, how's that going to happen? We will have to shorten our interviews. We'll be less able to more prone to error, will be less available to answer questions. All of that is diminished services. Another thing that the commissioner did, which is in that direction, is to eliminate the personal earnings and benefits statement. Now, this is a statement required by law to be mailed to every wage earner in the country who's 25 years or older. Now, they've cut those off about 18 months ago for budgetary purposes. They resumed them for people who were 60 years old and over. They planned with this budget of FY13 to start again to send them out to wage earners 25 years and older. But now the commissioner has put a stop to it completely. We are prohibited now from mailing these out. If somebody comes into an office, our employees will be given instructions that if somebody comes in and wants and requests a copy of their personal earnings and benefits statements, we have to tell them that we can't do it, that information that they're entitled to by law under the Freedom of Information Act, we're instructed now by the commissioner that we can't provide that information. And that piece of paper that people got every year that listed all their earnings and indicated, gave them an estimate of what they would get when they retired, was vital to the American public's understanding of how Social Security works, how their earnings, the fact that we know have a record of all their earnings that have gone into the trust fund, that their earnings are directly related to the benefit that they're going to receive, and now there's silence. They get no information. They're told, go online. Well, 52%, I believe, of people 65 and over have not used the Internet, according to a Pew survey that was done earlier this year. So there may be a lot of younger people who can go online and get that information. And even there, we're talking 15% of the youth population even doesn't use the Internet. So to say that that's the exclusive methodology of getting this information is just not right.
Vitold, I want to read you a quote from an SSA spokesman who commented on the reduced hours, and he said, quote, "We are operating on significantly less funding than either the agency or President Obama requested," end quote. What is your reaction to that response, and how much of this do you think the agency can control in terms of what they cut and where those reductions are put in place?
Well, there's no doubt that Congress has decided to slash our budget. And there is certainly a significant problem with this agency's ability to provide the traditional level of service to the public because of those cuts. We have lost 7,000 of the equivalent of 7,000 full-time employees over the last 2 years. The present continuing resolution may lead to another 2,000 loss. Now, 9,000 over 3 years is a huge major hit for this agency, and it makes it very difficult for the agency to process, you know, the work. So there needs to be an anticipation of the public. If you're going to allow your members of Congress to cut our budget, then it's going to affect the level of service that we provide. If currently we're processing a disability claim in about 115 days from the point that you file it and you get a decision and be it favorable or unfavorable, they're projecting that that's going to go up 2 to 3 weeks to like 138 days. If there's sequestration, the time will almost double. So somebody who, on average, will have their claim decided in close to 3 months, or 3.5 months, will now be waiting 7 months. And that's just the fact that if we're not there to do the work because of furloughs, if there's sequestration, then we just can't do the work. It's going to sit. So that's a reality. But there are savings that the agency can make, I think, to ameliorate those problems. For instance, they have hired and promoted all kinds of mid-level managers in the recent past. I think they're really their ratios of employee to management are very small, and they don't need as many managers as they have. There's a lot of offices that have 10 or 11 employees who have three management people working in there. That's ridiculous. They have a whole 42 different mid-level management offices called area director offices, which are throughout the country. They primarily do supervisory work of managers who work who run field offices where the public comes in to have their service. There's 10 regional offices above them who do the same task. Why do you need that those level of mid-level offices? Nobody goes. The public has no access to these 42 offices. They're paying millions and millions of dollars of rent for these 42 offices, and they're housed with 15 to 20 people each, who all they're doing is reviewing people's work, performing audits, and that kind of activity. If you're into a lean period of time, cut them. Why would you close a Social Security office in Klamath Falls, Oregon, which the agency did this year, and force employees, force the public to drive 80 miles through the mountains to the closest office and keep one of these other offices open, these area director's offices that have no public contact, is beyond me. They're closing an office in Ketchikan, Alaska, which is on an island, and the closest office is in Juneau, which you'd have to fly or take a boat to. These kinds of decisions, and they're keeping offices open, these area directors' offices open, that have no public contact. They got an office here. I live in, I work in Baltimore, in this big headquarters complex here. There's 10,000 people work here. Two exits down on the Beltway, there's an area director's office in Owings Mills. I've been there. Beautiful space. There's about 15, 20 people work there. I'm sure they pay hundreds of thousands of rent over the course of the year. There's plenty of vacant space in this building they could put that thing in. What kind of a wasteful expenditure is that? And instead, they're closing field offices that the public goes to on a daily basis for their service and leaving offices like this open. It's outrageous.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Witold Skwierczynski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, when we kicked off this conversation here today, I think one of the first things that you said was, for reasons not explained to the union. And I'm wondering if, to get to the bottom of this situation with the reduced hours, which clearly has an impact on the public, but also has an impact on the workforce doing the job, is this something that can be bargained over, or that you can get involved in some sort of conversations with the agency to see if a workable solution is possible?
Well, we've requested bargaining when the agency gave notice of the change. That now, their notice, unfortunately, was to the employees. Deputy Commissioner for Operations, Mary Glenn Croft, sent an email to every single employee in the operations part of the agency. She is the person that ultimately supervises whatever happens in the field offices and in the 800 number offices. And we reacted by making a bargaining request. We had a briefing, which provided very little information. In fact, they couldn't answer almost every question that we asked. And we have a meeting scheduled for today, this is Wednesday, getting more information, and we'll see what they tell us. But unfortunately, under Title 5, Chapter 71 of the U.S. Code, Civil Service Reform Act, we have limited bargaining rights on some management decisions. And in the case of the hours that are open to the public, that's a non-negotiable area. So we can't do anything about that. We could certainly talk to Congress, talk to the press, like I'm doing now, and inform the public of how we see the impact of these shorter office hours to try to put pressure on the commissioner to change his decision. And we could certainly negotiate what we perceive as some adverse impacts on this change, on how it'll affect employees with regards to changing how work is distributed and things of that nature. We can't really negotiate the hours that the offices are open to the public.
Witold, we've got just a couple of minutes left here, and I want to get your take on part of Social Security that a lot of people have questions about, and that's the long-term solvency of the program. You touched on it just a little bit earlier, but as we know, the majority of the funding for the benefit comes through the payroll tax deduction, somewhere around 70%, I believe. What do you think it's going to take to make sure that this program is thriving in the decades ahead?
Well, the program, the actuaries say the program's solvent for 22 years. In other words, the amount of revenue that comes in plus the trust fund, the accumulated dollars in the trust fund will pay full benefits that are projected to be paid out for the next 22 years. Now, critics argue, well, the trust fund is a fiction. It doesn't exist. Well, that's not true. The government has borrowed money, just like they borrow money from foreign countries, China in particular, to be able to pay off their debts. Now, one wouldn't think that the United States of America would default on their debt. So the expectation is that, you know, the government will repay the money they've borrowed from the trust fund, and that would make benefits assured for the next 22 years. Now, this is all based on economic projections. So there's let's say in 22 years, you know, they run out of money. That doesn't mean bankruptcy. That means people are going to get 80% of their entitled benefits. But of course, if nothing's done, that would create a 20% shortfall. So what things can be done? I think the major thing that can be done is to raise the taxation level for benefits. Most of us, over 90% of the American public pays taxes on every dime that they earn for Social Security and to FICA tax. Everyone who makes $110,100 or less pays taxes on everything that they earn. For some reason, people who earn over that stop paying taxes, and those are the ones that are most able to pay, the wealthy. Now, if you eliminate that cap on the tax base, that will pretty much solve the solvency problem. So I think it takes courage by Congress to say, look, we're gonna fix this in the future by lifting the wage cap so that all wage earners will be treated equally. All your wages will be paid for the Social Security tax like it is for over 90% of the people. The 7 or 8% who make over $110,000 aren't going to get this tax cut in effect, which causes down the road a potential problem in the solvency of the program.
Witold Skwierczynski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, always fun having you on the program. We appreciate your expertise here.
Glad to be on anytime.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the danger of reducing government services with Congressman Elijah Cummings.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Elijah Cummings, who represents the 7th District in Maryland. Congressman, welcome back to the program. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Good to be with you.
Of course, we are here today together at the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte. What is your take so far on what you've seen?
So far, I've been very impressed. And I don't say that just as a Democrat. I say that as a citizen of this country. We watched and listened to the truth where Michelle Obama basically laid out the case for why this president should retain office for another 4 years. And she talked about her life with him and her love for him and how both of their lives had been filled with struggle. and in many instances filled with pain and frustration. And by the way, debt, and how they were able to overcome it. But more importantly, how they took their struggle and their pain and turned it into a passport to try to help all Americans.
You, of course, mentioned the speech from Michelle Obama, the First Lady. Her speech, as you noted, was a very personal speech.
Yes.
Talked, as you mentioned, about the love that she has for her husband. Do you think it was important for the American people to see or at least learn of the president in a different light like that, the way that someone like his wife views him?
Yeah, I think it was very important, and the way she did it. It's one thing, you know, being married myself, you know, your spouse is, assuming you've got a good marriage, your number one fan. So you expect them to say good things about you. So it wasn't that, it's not necessarily the complimentary thing she said, but it's the way she said it and how she painted this picture of two people who were on a mission to make a difference, and how she talked about their pain and that pain being turned into passion and that passion being turned into purpose and that purpose being turned into a mission. And so I'll give you a perfect example that showed this when she talked about Pell Grants and why they are so committed to expanding Pell Grants. Why? Because just 8 or 9 years ago, they were still in debt from college loans. So he didn't have to go, then they didn't have to go, she didn't have to go back 2, 3, 4 generations to talk about this, you know, the struggles. She talked about the struggles of she and her husband. Another one, healthcare. I mean, when you listen to what she said about her father, and of course we know the story of his mother who died of cancer, and one of the last things she did was trying to go through papers, trying to figure out how she could get some coverage, to take care of certain cancer medications. So those are things, again, those are painful things, but they were able to turn them into a passion to make a difference. And so, and you know what I think? I think when you present the case like she did, it's very, very difficult for any kind of opposition to really question your motives, because they simply makes sense for you to do what you're doing.
Those were very real life examples of what they went through.
Right.
And other real life examples that other people are going through are job situations. A lot of people are out of work still. We know that's going to be a central issue in the elections coming up. Where do you see that issue going in the months ahead?
Well, first of all, the Republicans are not going to allow this president to have any success stories between now and the election with regard to jobs. As a matter of fact, I am convinced that they were determined to be obstructionists, and they have been very effective at doing it. I am also convinced that one of the things that the president will have to do once he's reelected, and I think that even if he wins by one vote, it will be a mandate, and I'll explain that in a second, that he has to say, now, look, I'm here. You tried by any means necessary to stop me. You tried to shut down the vote by voting these so-called voter fraud laws. You tried all kinds of shenanigans with regard to redistricting. You even tried to shut down the League of Women Voters from registering people. You had all the money that God could provide through Citizens United, and I still won. So I got a mandate. Now let's go and create some jobs. I think that's going to be, and I think he'll go back to some of the things that he's already tried. We've got a bill sitting in the House that they refused to vote on that would bring more police officers and bring more teachers that we desperately need and bring more infrastructure spending so that we can address these issues. And I think that's going to be next. I really do.
As a member of the House of Representatives, working with other Republicans in the House, are you able to make some headway with some of them on some certain issues? What is it like being in that
process? I have found almost no success in trying to do that. Now, let me try to explain that. When you talk to Republicans, there are some Republicans that I think would like to be slightly moderate, but they will tell you in a minute that if they cooperate with you, they are going to be punished. I mean, if you look, let me give you a perfect example, La Tourette. Up there in Ohio. I think one of the things that made him leave early is just simply frustration. I mean, he was one of the guys that I, you know, we sat on the Transportation Committee for 16 years together. We worked together on all kinds of things. And now this new bunch, this right-wing bunch that's come in here, the Tea Party, basically wagging, is a tail wagging the dog. I mean, in other words, they are basically controlling things. That's how we got stuck in that debt ceiling situation. We've never had those kind of problems before. So what I'm saying to you is that we've got a situation where it's almost impossible to get any kind of compromise on anything. And the Republicans have come in since at least since 2010 and said my way or the highway.
As we close out here, I want to ask you one more thing, and that is how all of this that we've discussed here today impacts the federal employee. We know that they are oftentimes put in almost like a political football.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this leave them?
I think the federal employee has been made to be a political football. And, of course, a lot of their issues come before my committee, Government Reform and Oversight. There is rarely a hearing that takes place where Republicans are not slamming public employees. They claim they want to reduce government. They want to reduce their pensions. They want to pay more towards their pensions and get less. They want their salaries frozen. They want to fire them. People at the Postal Service, although I know they don't get federal money, but it's a government-type operation. They want to let 100,000+ of them go with no real package to help them, to ease them out. So I think for federal employees, this election is extremely important. I think that you will see government reduce even further. And keep in mind, government is already at a very, I mean, when you look at per capita, we're pretty low already right now.
I don't think people know that very much either.
Oh, yeah. We're very low. And so, I mean, and I don't know what's next. The other thing that's so interesting, a lot of times when they try to shut down operations, you know the next step is to take those responsibilities and give them to private industry. And it usually costs a lot more to do it through the private industry. And so, again, this is a very important election for government employees. As you may recall, the president was trying to get a 0.5% raise and had to basically hold that up. And salaries are being frozen. So hopefully we'll be able to unfreeze some of that once he's elected. But if he is not reelected, I venture to guess that these freezes may go on for another 4 or 5 years.
Congressman Elijah Cummings from the 7th District in Maryland. Congressman, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss ideas to spark the manufacturing sector with Congressman Adam Schiff.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Adam Schiff from California. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Sitting here today with you at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, what have you taken away from the event so far this week?
It's been a great convention so far, and I continue to be just really blown away by how impressive the First Lady was last night. What a riveting speech. And very telling about her own character, about the president's character. It just really was fascinating and very moving.
One of the things that the First Lady brought up in her speech was her and the president's path through the American dream to where they are today. They faced all the same problems that every middle-class American faces, with a lot of student debt and their own struggles along the way to get to where they are. How much does that speak to just the general place that we're in as a country today?
I think it really resonates with just so many millions of American families. What they were describing is their part of the American dream, how the American dream happened for their family. And it's something that we can all relate to. If you go back far enough, all of us are fairly new to this country. All of us have struggled. All of our ancestors have struggled. And I'm sure that their grandparents and great-grandparents are amazed or would be amazed at what they've been able to achieve. And that's true for so many. But I think what they set out, what she set out last night, was the fact that that dream is increasingly challenged. And we have to make sure that we can deliver that dream to our children and the next generation after that. And that's not going to mean going back to the same kind of trickle-down economics that we heard about in the last convention.
What is it going to take to get the middle class back on track and get the economy thriving again in this country?
Well, I think it's going to take a number of things. I think, among others, it's very important for us to bring manufacturing back to America. It's not enough to be just a service economy. And that means we have to incentivize the manufacturing process here. It's not going to be sufficient to just invent the next iPad or do the next startup if it means the production of that product is going to take place elsewhere. It may mean tens of thousands of jobs here, but it has meant hundreds of thousands of jobs elsewhere, and we want those jobs in America. So I think we have to end some of the disincentives. Right now we allow people tax credits to move their businesses overseas. That's crazy. We have to reverse the incentives and encourage people to make it America again. I also think that there's much of the nation's infrastructure that's in bad need of repair. Roads and bridges and highways, the renewable energy superhighway, these are things that ought to be the subject of a national investment. And part of the reason why it's so key is we need these infrastructure improvements, but also until the construction industry comes back, we will not prosper again. So it would help that industry and all those that supply and depend on that industry.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening with you and your constituents in Burbank. What are they saying about the national conversation?
Well, you know, I think it's a mixture of things. You know, they are deeply concerned about the economy. That's a foremost issue in the L.A. suburbs that I represent, just as it is elsewhere. They're also, I think, very dismayed at the dysfunctionality of government, both the state government in Sacramento and the federal government in Washington. They want people to get down to the business of moving the country forward, to roll up their sleeves, to find common ground. And what is so perplexing to them and so excruciatingly frustrating to me is that this country and the state of California have all the same talented people, natural resources, great attributes that have made the country great and my home state great. Right now, our problems are man-made, and they can be fixed, but we have to find a way to work together to get it done.
About 6 months ago, the Supreme Court heard the arguments for and against the Affordable Care Act, the health care law. What was your take on the decision that was made, and where do you see the Affordable Care Act going in the future?
Well, I was very pleased that the Supreme Court reached the decision it did for a couple of reasons. One, I think the health care reform is a very important step forward in ensuring millions of people that don't have access to health care, in helping young people stay in their parents' policies, and helping seniors pay for prescription drugs, and helping people with pre-existing conditions get health care. So for all those policy reasons, very important, but also as a watcher of the court, as a co-chair of the House Caucus on the Judiciary, I've been very concerned about the increasingly partisan path that the Supreme Court has been walking down. And had this Supreme Court struck down health care on a party line basis, on the basis of the party of the president who appointed them, that would have, for many people, cemented the view that this Supreme Court had just become another partisan institution. So I think it was also very important for the court that it reached the conclusion it did.
As someone who represents a district in California, you are in the body, the legislature, that most closely touches the American people. What is it like going to work every day? And is it really that difficult to work with the other side? I think that's a question that the American people might want to know the answer to, is it that divisive?
Well, it's interesting. In most respects, yes, it is that divisive, and that has simply got to change. The parties can't look at every issue and every bill through the prism of what's going to advance the next election or election prospects, what's going to advance staying in the majority or gaining the majority. That's not going to cut it anymore. But I do have the opportunity on the Intelligence Committee to work on a committee where there really is bipartisan work done, really nonpartisan work. It's telling, though, that this, which I think is now the most productive committee on the Hill, is the only committee that meets, by and large, in secret. We have a few open hearings, but most of our hearings are classified, and there's no grandstanding, in part because there's no one to grandstand to. And that's kind of a sad commentary, that the most productive committee is also one that's not most in the public eye. Certainly we can't classify all of our committees. That's not the answer. But we have to find a way to create the same dynamic in a public environment where people don't just use the opportunity to take pot shots against each other.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Adam Schiff from California. Congressman, inside those meetings, the classified meetings that you have on that committee, do you find that the dialogue and the conversation is different than the other meetings and committees?
It is, and I really do think that a big part of it is there's a camaraderie and a focus on the end game of protecting the country. And we don't have the distraction of being in a highly politicized, open environment where, the parties want you to throw grenades at each other. And I wish we could recreate that environment in the broader Congress. We really need to. I've been around long enough to know there's an ebb and flow to the political process. We're at a very partisan flow right now, and it will ebb, but there are serious challenges facing the country, and the sooner the better.
And I'm sure that a lot of the things that happen behind the scenes when the cameras aren't around, you're probably able to work more closely and more effectively with everyone in Congress. It just doesn't always get reported on. I imagine that's probably part of it. But when people say that Congress is broken, do you agree, and how does that make you feel?
Well, unfortunately, I do agree in substantial part. I mean, there is a whole category of issues that do get resolved, and they aren't the top of the chart. They're not the front page of the newspaper. They're things that still matter a great deal to our constituents. But on those ultra-important issues, for example, many of the big fiscal issues that are coming due at the end of the year, we have been broken. We've been kicking this can down the road. We haven't been able to come to a bipartisan shared sacrifice that we can present to the American people and say, look, we're going to get our fiscal house in order. Here's how we're going to do it. It's going to have plenty for everyone not to like. But we agree, Democrats and Republicans, this is the best thing to do, the best way forward. If we had that, if we can visualize just for a minute, the president, the Democratic and Republican leaders of House and Senate on the White House steps announcing a broad agreement, the country would embrace it, sacrifice and all. They really want this of their leadership, but as yet we haven't delivered.
It seems as though when those times come and everyone's on the steps together, it's almost at a time of national crisis. 9/11 comes to mind when everyone was on the steps at the Capitol coming together. And I'm sure at some point you would probably like to get everyone on the steps again when it's not a national crisis.
Well, absolutely. And it's gotten more difficult for several reasons, not the least of which now, because you have these very well-funded super PACs that will, you know, beat the heck out of anyone who departs from the party orthodoxy. You have some of the dynamic in the all-news world where the cable stations, people tune into the news. They want to reinforce the views they had before they turned on the news. And so you aren't subject to the same cross-fertilization of ideas. But notwithstanding all this, it's nothing that can't be fixed and addressed if we have the right leadership to do it.
Congressman Adam Schiff, representing California's 29th District, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure to have you on the program, and thank you for sharing some of the insights into Congress and how it works.
My pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's Safe Sleep Campaign with spokeswoman Nikki Fleming.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Nikki Fleming, the spokeswoman for the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Nikki, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Nikki, you are the team lead for the Safe Sleep campaign at the Commission. Tell me a little bit about that campaign.
Yes, the Consumer Product Safety Commission is interested in keeping babies safe as well as consumers in their homes from consumer products. We have a large responsibility to keep what we call our most vulnerable population, the young babies, safe. So we are working on regulations to keep consumer products safe, such as cribs and high chairs and strollers and all the products that you may have in your home.
Now, people may think, okay, a crib, everything's fine, but there are some dangers associated with having a baby in a crib, right?
Correct. In recent years, the commission has recalled over 11 million cribs. A lot of those were drop side cribs, and the problem was the side rails were detaching. Babies were getting caught. We've had over 32 infant deaths where babies have gotten caught in that detachment between the side rail and the crib itself. So we want to reduce strangulation deaths. And so we created a new standard as of last year, in June of last year, June 28, 2011. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has a new crib standard. All cribs sold today must meet these new regulations.
What were the old regulations for the cribs?
Over the years, this is the most comprehensive regulation that we've had when we've taken a comprehensive look at five elements. So in addition to some of the older standards, which were slat spacing and things like that, we're also looking at slat strength now, mattress support durability, prohibiting what we call the traditional drop sides, making the hardware stronger, and we also require tougher testing now.
And one of the things that you are suggesting to mothers and fathers is to eliminate the clutter around the baby and in the baby's room, right?
Yes. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, we can work on regulations of the actual product, but we need to definitely educate parents about adding additional elements into the crib. So a baby can be cozy without all the clutter. So you want to remove quilts, comforters, cushions, pillows out of the baby's crib, place baby on its back always. And this is also in cooperation with other organizations such as the American Academy of Pediatrics to reduce SIDS as well.
So the idea is bare is best.
Correct. Right. So bare is best. And we have a new publication out. And this document can be downloaded from our website and placed as a poster in any area where children and parents may be to remind everyone to keep your areas bare as best. And not only your cribs, but that include other safe sleep environments like a bassinet or a play yard as well.
And as I understand, this is all part of Baby Safety Month.
Correct. We're definitely highlighting this again because it's Baby Safety Month. So what a great time for parents to check for product recalls in their home. They can sign up to get direct notification from the Commission on Product Recalls. We do have jurisdiction over not only children's products, but everything in the home. So you can go to cpsc.gov and sign up to get free direct notices.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Tell me about the agency's roles and responsibilities and how it really helps the American people.
Sure. We have a large responsibility, over 15,000 categories of products CPSC is responsible for. So that would include just about everything in your home with the exception of food and drugs. That would be, of course, the FDA's jurisdiction. But CPSC is responsible for your electronics, your appliances, your furniture, we talked about all of the nursery products, children's toys is another big category.
Are you talking about how those products work or what is in them or both?
Both. Exactly. Anything that could expose or create what we call a potential hazard or potential injury to a consumer. That's what we're trying to prevent, injuries and deaths. Our mission is to prevent injuries and deaths associated with consumer products. So again, we also, things like lawnmowers, for instance, and making sure they're mechanically working safely. And if for some reason we find a product has a problem, we will work with that manufacturer to give a consumer in a recall options between a repair, a replacement, or a refund sometimes.
How do the companies respond to those regulations that you put on them?
The good news for consumers is that the majority of our recalls are voluntary with the recalling firm. So we do work cooperatively with the recalling firms to make sure that there's a remedy. And what we want consumers to know is to do their part on the other side and take advantage of those remedies. Make sure you're hearing about the recalls and then taking advantage of the remedies.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Nikki Fleming, a spokeswoman for the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Nikki, let's talk a little bit about your role in the commission. I know that you're on these campaigns and you're working to make sure that the public is aware, but as a public affairs specialist, that's really the nuts and bolts of what you do, is making sure that people understand, one, what the agency does, and two, to communicate it effectively in a way that they're going to understand.
Definitely. We have a big job to get all of the great work that the Consumer Product Safety Commission and our CPSC staff works on every day. And we have a hard, dedicated staff committed to making sure consumers stay safe in their homes from consumer products. So we definitely want to hear from consumers. That's one of the best ways we receive our information. We do have a toll-free hotline. Consumers can report directly to us. We have a saferproducts.gov site where you can actually see information that other consumers have put up about perhaps problems they may have had with a consumer product, and that could possibly lead us to an action.
I sense a lot of passion and dedication in your voice for what you do.
I do love it. I think it comes from a background and a family of public servants, and also literally I started while in college and stayed for 20 years, so I do love what I do, and I feel like we're making a difference. I feel like the Consumer Product Safety Commission is making a difference, and we're saving lives.
Do you get feedback from the American people about the things that you're doing and the ways that you're helping them?
Yes. The CPSC, again, does have a toll-free 1-800-638-2772 hotline. We have live operators there, and I work with them regularly as well, to hear information coming in from consumers, concerns about a product, concerns about perhaps taking advantage of a remedy. So it's our job to also make sure that that's all working correctly and that consumers are in turn getting what they need.
What's the favorite thing about your job?
Talking to people like you, I think. Definitely, because you help magnify our job. Sitting at my desk, of course, I can do what I can do, but obviously talking with the media and getting the information out to thousands of people, millions of people, is really important.
I think it's important for people to know about people like you, the job that you do, the agency that you work in. They're strictly to serve the American people.
It's true, and the level of expertise. I work with PhDs and tons of engineers who are looking at all the specificity and working on the regulations and evaluating. So the good news, again, for consumers is that we're out here working for you.
How difficult is it for you to take something from a PhD or an engineer and construct the message in a way that the American people are going to understand through your social media, through press releases, advertisements, things like that?
It sometimes can be challenging, but I think overall, because we're all committed to the same end result, like you said, we want to, if CBSC's message is not well received or consumers are a little not understanding what we're trying to say, then we probably haven't done the best job. So our job, definitely, again, here in the communications office, is to make sure that information is getting clearly stated to the consumer. And again, that they take that action is really important. We all are sitting on hundreds of products probably in our home right now that are under our CPSC's jurisdiction. So again, you want to go and look and check, sign up to get the direct email notifications. And again, a lot of times consumers may not even realize that they have a remedy.
One last time, if our listeners want to learn more about your agency, where can they find you?
They can find us at the Consumer Product Safety Commission at cpsc.gov. And we also host the site saferproducts.gov. And for the parents out there with the young babies and young children, we have a special crib information center with a lot of our children's products. And that's cpsc.gov/cribs.
Nikki Fleming, the spokeswoman for the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. Nikki, thank you for your time today and your dedication to the American people.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals, President Witold Zwierczynski, Congressman Elijah Cummings and Adam Schiff, and U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission spokeswoman Nikki Fleming. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View for Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government.